laying in that bunk and looking out the window on the big barbed wire, thinking, I was never shaking my fist at God, but I did think, are you sure you're in control? Because it doesn't quite feel like it.
Well, that's Bo Mitchell, and he and his wife Gary are with us today on Focus on the Family with a powerful story that you're going to appreciate. Your host is Focus President and author Jim Daly.
John, I'm excited about the conversation today. We're going to speak with two very good friends, Bo and Gary Mitchell, and we have done things together. Bo often speaks on behalf of Focus on the Family. He helps us with events that we put on. These are great people, and they have an incredible story. In fact, years ago, they shared some of that story with Dr. Dobson. I think it was back in 1994. And we're going to talk more in depth with them at this time because we have worked with Tyndale and published a book with Bo and Gary that I think will impact so many people to learn how to get through difficult days when you don't feel or sense that God is walking with you. And you're going to benefit from it.
Yeah, in fact, the book is called Grace Behind Bars. And in this book, Bo and Gary share very transparently about some of the struggles. And Bo is right now the chaplain and senior advisor for the Colorado Rockies, our hometown Major League Baseball team here in Colorado. And Gary is the director of consulting services with Crosswalk Fellowship. And they've been married for over 45 years.
Hey, first of all, congratulations on being married 45 years.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Gary, not you, Bo. That's incredible, Gary. How could you put up with him?
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's been wonderful for probably 26 of us.
Very nice.
Hey, I love that honesty. Welcome back to Focus on the Family.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's been a while. You finally decided to put this down in a book. It's a powerful story. We're going to get more into that detail, but let's start by letting the listeners hear more about who you are, where you're coming from, the type of people you were back then, and then we'll get into the trouble that you found yourself in. Tell us about your families and what it was like for each of you growing up. Let's start with Gary. Why don't we start there? Gary, what kind of family did you come from?
I grew up in a really great family. I have an older brother, two younger sisters, and terrific parents. I remember my mom making these great meals every night, and we were just close. I grew up in Denver and graduated from South High School and then went to the University of Colorado. And I always loved music. So when I was in, right after high school, I joined a singing group called the Folks About Town. And I sang in this group for a long time, and Bo and I actually met through that group.
Let me ask you this, Gary. You seem to be, in some ways, and, you know, Bo, you and I are buddies, so take this right. You seem to be an anchor kind of person, meaning, you know, you're solid. You're the anchor, asking the right questions. Is this the direction we need to go? Where are the boundaries? Is that a fair description when I describe you that way?
So what you're saying is I'm kind of even keel and Bo's not.
Well, you can describe it however you'd like.
But totally even keel.
You know, typically that's how God pulls us together as couples. We're not exact people. We don't think the same way. Typically, we're opposites. And when I think of you two as a couple, married 45 years now, I think of you in that way, kind of the person that's saying, can we really afford that? You sure you want to do that? Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair, and I thank you for that. I would say that I'm definitely more an introvert, and he's definitely more an extrovert. We both love to be funny. We love humor, but I would say that's an accurate.
Well, that's good because
as
we unfold your story, humor is critical because of the difficulty you're into. Okay, Bo, putting his hand up.
Helen Dye, who is one of our best friends, passed away a few years ago. She would very respectfully say, those of us that know Bo and Gary the best know that Gary really wears the pants. Well, Bo is just following her lead. So that's kind of what you're saying.
No, it's not what I'm saying, Bo. It's just sometimes, you know, usually between a couple, God makes sure somebody is sensible. That's what I'm saying.
It's not
about pants or no pants. It's just about who's got the sensibility to say, hey, are you sure?
Yeah.
And that's fair. Now, you do like to have fun, and that's why I enjoy just hanging out with you when we do the Focus events. I love your personality. It is extroverted. It is outgoing. You want people to feel comfortable. That's how I would describe you, but you describe yourself. What were your growing up years like, and who are you, and what kind of family are you coming from?
Let's see. My dad, Dale Mitchell, was a great Major League Baseball player in the 40s and 50s. Had 9.5 seasons where he hit .312 for the Cleveland Indians and then was traded to the Dodgers. But
you were how old when he was playing the big leagues?
7 years old when he quit. So my earliest years were spent just kind of tending ball games, going back and forth from Cleveland to Oklahoma City where we lived. But because of my dad's fame as an athlete, sports was the major theme in our home. We had alcohol issues with my dad from the time I think I first can remember. It was never knowing for sure you're going to get stroked or swatted as a kid because what kind of mood was dad in? And he was a great guy, funny, obviously great success in business after his baseball career because of his competitiveness, but tough.
What was that like being a 5, 6, 7 year old going to the Cleveland Stadium and probably doing some road games? What was that? Was it heady? Did you understand at 7 years old that, hey, my dad's, he's pretty much the stuff?
Yes and no. I mean, on one hand, he's just dad. On the other hand, especially in the 40s and 50s, if you think about it, if you were a Major League Baseball star, you were one of the most famous athletes. I was always just proud of it. I always had this feeling that more was expected of me because of who he was, but that didn't bother me either. I just thought, by the fifth grade on, you know, this is fun, yes, but it's more fun to win. It's more fun to clobber these people we're playing. It's more fun to score 20 points than not score any points in basketball or hit a home run and strike out. So none of that bothered me, but I was just proud of my dad.
You had an experience, I think, in the World Series. Your dad did, but it affected you and your mom and your family. Describe that whole event, because I think it brings all of us a little closer to who you are and who your dad was. What happened?
I was sitting in the stands with my mom. That's what you're referring to, Jim, at the 1956 World Series on October 8th. It was the fifth game of the series, Yankees against the Dodgers, and I got to go to the World Series that year because my big brother, Dale Jr., had gone in 1954 when the Indians got clobbered by the Giants. But on that day in 1956, the Yankee pitcher Don Larsen was mowing down the Dodgers, and pretty soon the word spread nationwide and millions of people were tuned in to what turned out to be the only perfect game ever pitched in World Series history. So a no-hitter is good. Means nobody gets a hit for the opposing team. A perfect game means nobody reaches base. No walks, no errors, nothing. 26 up, 26 down, and the last batter the Dodgers called to the plate was my father, Dale Mitchell. So I can remember his name being announced over the PA system and my mother pulling me up real close to her and saying, "Son, keep your mouth shut. If your dad gets a hit right now, these Yankee fans might kill us." And I was thinking, wait a minute. I thought we were just watching a ball game here. This got rather serious. And, of course, not wanting to disappoint the whole world, my dad struck out, ended the game, and that thrust me into therapy for the rest of my life.
Well, I mean, it's an incredible story, but it just paints that picture. Describe for us how you two met and how the Lord brought together these colliding forces in Bo and Gary.
Well, first of all, I always loved sports growing up, so we had that in common, and we had some other issues. I had a few alcohol problems in my family, too. I came to Christ through Young Life when I was 19, and he came to Christ when he was 15 with Young Life, so we had a lot of things in common when we met, and then he had a roommate, Tim Evans, who was a good friend of mine, up in Boulder. And so Tim Evans said, "Hey, I've got this friend of mine who's singing in this nightclub with these two guys in Denver. Would you like to come down?" So he came down with this group and he walked in and I thought, huh, he's pretty cute. But then
you thought I was extremely squirrely.
I did. I did a little bit, but
I love the "but then" comment.
Yes, but then. Yes.
He was really cute, but then
there's more.
Fill that blank in for us.
But then. So he was his normal, you know, just outgoing, fun, really cute, 6'3", he's blonde, he's handsome, blue eyes. I mean, I just thought, this is a pretty cool guy. But then we were walking out, he said, would you like to go out sometime? And I thought, oh, I don't know, you know, I was working a lot. And then he looked at me, and he was walking behind me, and he said, boy, you have got great wheels.
Great. And baseball term for legs.
I said, come on. What does that
Everybody
mean?
Everybody knows that, right?
And I just thought, oh, I really. But anyway, that's how
great
we met.
Wheels. You
that's
run
how
fast.
We met.
And you so must have been running away from him.
Really?
No, he did. Anyway, it was so funny. So
you said yes. That caught you. That
I
phrase.
Said yes, it did. I wouldn't, you know, recommend that to anyone. But it was cute. And then we started dating, maybe a couple of weeks later. I was just finishing up my time with this group, and I was going to school at the time. The three of us were going to school at the time, and so I was kind of done with that. And then we started dating in a couple of weeks.
I thought it was two nights later, actually, and we got engaged in 3 weeks. So I view
true.
It as a God deal that mm-hmm. we just talked all the time. So I was in the middle of basketball, baseball preparation at CU, and I said to my friend Tim Evans, wait a minute, this beautiful girl is a friend of your family's, and you've never taken her on a date. He's like, no, you think she's cute? And I said, it doesn't matter anymore. You're out of the picture because I'm taking
You cut the
out.
Conversation off.
I really, it was just a God deal. He put us together.
Take us to the story that is the story, Grace Behind Bars, the title of your book, that begins to peel back everything about who you are. What kind of business guy were you? I'm assuming at that point you're pursuing the Lord. You have a relationship with God. I don't know what that was like. You could describe it for us. But you were an honest person, right?
Oh, yeah. And Gary and I were very involved in ministry. We had been on the Young Life Committee there in Boulder. In our first years of marriage, we did Christian Marriage Encounter retreats where we would teach together. And 1982, Jim and Barb Dixon, Bob and Allison Belts, and Gary and I started Cherry Hills Community Church in Denver.
Which is a huge church today. I mean, that's big.
Yeah, 10,000 plus probably now members. But we were just kind of doing what we thought was obedient. Now, I unfortunately took the same competitiveness I'd learned from my dad in sports into the business world and into ministry. So it was always a little bit fire-ready aim for me, just too quick on everything, frankly. And I thought there was something to be gained by thinking that quickly and responding to things that quickly. So business, I was never a big-time real estate developer, but I was doing well, making a lot of money. We would still see that, you know, all our heads needed to be in the game in terms of business. Our hearts were in ministry. So the very start of this story, Grace Behind Bars, happened in 1984 when Cherry Hills built a new building, and some of the guys that had helped me to sign personal guarantees to build the church asked me 35 days later if I would borrow money to help them with some of their cash flow problems in business.
So these are guys in the church?
Yep, in the church, good friends, And I view them still today as good people that maybe made some mistakes, but hey, don't we all?
Well, that's generous given the story that's going to unfold. But before we get there, let me just remind folks that are listening to Focus on the Family, and today our guests are Bo and Gary Mitchell. We're covering their memoir, really their biography, Grace Behind Bars, and we're about to crack that story open. And before we move there, though, a part of the story, Bo, is Gary, you as Bo's wife, what kind of man is he at this point? What are you seeing? What kind of father was he to the kids?
You know, you said a minute ago, Bo, were you an honest man? And I've never known anyone other than, I mean, I've known a lot of people, but Bo has the most incredible reputation. He's a person that if he says he's going to do something for you, he does it. I've never known him to lie. All he cares about is helping people. He's an amazing person, and I've always been so very, very proud to be his wife. And he was a great dad. He's always been a great dad. And he was very involved with business. I think he was working, I don't know, Bo, like 20 hours a week getting Cherry Hill started for about 5 years.
On top of the regular
jobs. On top of the regular jobs. And he was going to seminary at the time, getting his degree. I always think that Bo can do like 3 jobs in the time most people can do 1 job. So I just tag along and... So anyway, when you say that, I just want everyone to know what a great person he is.
Okay, now let's move to the story, Bo. There you are, a good guy, responsive to mm-hmm. all, trying to be a good Christian man by being there for your mm-hmm. friends. This money has been requested by the community of believers to help build the church. 2 of these guys put in some money. You feel, I'm sure, a bit obligated because you're one of the founding members of the church. They then come back to you 35 days later and say, Bo, we kind of need your help too. Would you be able to do some loans in our direction for some business purposes? Take it from there. What happens?
Gary and I are comfortable saying that I felt in borrowing this money to help these friends, I was doing something heroic and noble. The banker who asked me, would I help them, was also a good friend, also part of our Bible study groups in our church. And the whole meeting took about 10 minutes. So what was wrong with me in those days is too fast, not enough checks and balances, too confident that everything I touched was going to work out, too loud, too aggressive, too much ego, too much pride. If we want to start a church, we buy a building, we open the doors, and everybody comes. Why wouldn't they? If we want to start a television program to talk about Christ, we walk into Channel 4, we present it to them, and they say, sure, when do you want to start? And I said, I don't even know what I'm talking about. But
So really trusting, too. That's a key factor here. You had a trusting attitude toward those around you.
I did. And And I love those guys, and I felt what I did was noble and heroic and did the paperwork properly.
So how much did you borrow?
$200,000.
And you, in essence, you borrowed this money to give to these other people to invest in other things that you weren't quite clear on.
No, I knew that their company they had just purchased, the big company in Denver, was having cash flow problems, and I know this was to fund 1 month of cash flow problems they were having. But I was happy to do it, and... they signed notes back to me, and the money was repaid in a orderly fashion.
Timely way. I mean, you met those obligations.
Yes.
Did the money you repaid come from them or from you?
Came from them. From them, back to me.
And you paid it off.
Yeah.
So everything seemed right. And then what happened? Who contacted you with some concerns?
7 years later, the FBI asked if they could have an appointment with me. Well, we'd never had anything in our life worse than a traffic ticket, so why wouldn't I talk to the FBI? So I met with this guy, which I shouldn't have, and he asked me to put a wire on and go to these same friends, a few of which had filed bankruptcy by then and had really struggled financially because in the 80s, the S&L crisis and the real estate collapse caused some damage, and this FBI agent didn't like it when I smiled and said, you know, sorry, but I'm now a team chaplain for the Denver Nuggets, associate pastor of a church. I'm not going to put a wire on and get these people to incriminate themselves. I said, I'll tell you the truth, but I'm not stretching a story to help you nail these guys for something you think was criminal.
So he was asking you basically to go undercover and do some spying on your friends.
Yeah, that's what it felt like to me.
Well, we want to say, you know, we want to respect law enforcement, obviously. And sometimes some things go awry. They're trying to do a job. We have many friends in the FBI that support Focus on the Family, and they're good people. So I want to make sure we get that disclaimer in there. But sometimes law enforcement can get really aggressive in their duty. And this
sometimes
might be,
we cross the line when this guy looked at me and said, well, in that case, we're going to fry your rear end.
That's what he said to you.
Yeah. And I said, can you talk to people that way? And he said, I can, I do, and I will follow through.
And what happened? I mean, there you are, kind of being in the vernacular of that underworld. I mean, you're being strung out there, right? You don't have many good choices.
Correct. And Gary used the word terrorized. We felt terrorized for about the next 6 months, wouldn't you say?
Yes, we definitely felt terrorized. I remember when Bo came home after the first meeting in August, and He said, this is the phone call I got, and I went and had this meeting. And he's like, I've never been a part of anything like this. And I said, and we'd never watched, there was a show at the time called Law and Order. Anyone remember that?
It still airs, I think.
It is. We didn't know anything about anything. We didn't know anyone that had gone to prison. We didn't know anybody that had been in a criminal thing.
This wasn't your world.
This was not our world. It was just something that was so foreign to us. And also with this loan that Bo did with these friends, this was the only business deal he ever did with them.
How does this continue to unwind then, Bo? What are the next steps that law enforcement now takes or the FBI to shore up their case? And they're obviously going after somebody in this.
Yes, and they said I was not a target, and I got an attorney involved from our church, and he kind of thought it was all a joke, you know. That
the attorney?
Yeah, I'm not sure he spent much time reading the documents. And even at some point, Chuck Colson, who had become a casual friend through a mutual friend in Denver, but he said to me, you know, plea bargaining is a tough thing, you know, be careful. But he said, you ought to pray there's something you did wrong technically. You ought to plead guilty so you can just sign your name and move on with your life.
Now, this is Chuck Colson, the man who went to prison for Watergate.
Yes.
And became a wonderful Christian leader and built prison fellowship. But you would take his advice pretty seriously.
Yes. And law firms, a couple law firms that were advising me that just said, look, these people are tough to deal with. They normally, like you said, Jim, they normally are dealing with criminals. But anyway, having been promised probation, what it felt like is the government was on a shopping spree through my life, just looking for anything I'd done. I likened it to, this would be like the motor vehicle division calling you and saying, you know, we have you on video for the last 20 years, and we think there's a couple of moving violations in there over the last 20 years. That's what it felt like. They're shopping for something I did wrong. And finally, these loans you mentioned, they said, this is called straw borrowing. If you borrow money for a third party knowing that they can't borrow anymore from a bank, in other words, you're kind of a middleman.
Right.
That is written in a federal statute and is a felony. And I said, well, I've never heard the term. Doesn't it matter that the money was repaid? They said, no, technically you did that.
That's the irony in this whole story, is that everything on the outside, meaning the payment of the loan, the repayment of the loan, took place.
Well, I got no fine from the judge, so I didn't pay a dollar fine. There was no restitution because there wasn't anything owed. But it's just interesting that the statute itself says I coerced, induced, and procured the commission of bank fraud. That's what I ended up pleading guilty to, thinking to save my family and my friends from this terror we were feeling, plead guilty, sign your name, go on with your life. So with the promise of probation, that's what I did. And this is really not what the book's about. The book's about how we recovered from this, because what happened was everybody seemed to get the message of this promise of probation, except the judge. He kept referring to general deterrence in this final hearing, where I thought he'd pat me on the back and tell me to keep up the good work. And he said, the least I can do for you is sentence you to 11 months in federal prison.
Yeah, I mean, that had to land like a hammer. You thought you were going to, in essence, get your hand slapped for something you didn't even know was illegal.
Correct.
And now you're a felon.
Yes. Yeah, it was. Had I been told that, it's not the way we would have played out our end of the deal. We'd have fought him and gone to court.
Well, Bo and Gary, man, this is intense. And not many of us are going to be convicted on a felony. And there's so much more we want to uncover with your story. Let's come back next time, continue the story, and hear more about how God intervened and brought you through this gutter in order to teach you how to be more like him. Can we do that?
We would love to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we do hope you'll be able to join us next time to hear the rest of the Mitchell story. On behalf of Jim Daly and the entire team, thanks for listening. I'm John Fuller.
We've heard a very interesting account of Bo and Gary Mitchell's run-in with the law. But this couple has a beautiful testimony of the way in which God used that devastating experience in their lives for the good of their family. And we're going to hear just how God intervened and brought this couple through that ordeal on tomorrow's program. So do join us for that. The Mitchells have written about their story in a book called Grace Behind Bars. And in it, they share how they struggled together as their world fell apart, yet ultimately grew closer to each other and God behind the bars of their trials. To order your copy of this inspiring story, visit our website at safamily.co.za or call us on 031-716-3300. We've entered into the month of May, and I want to let you know that Focus on the Family has joined a collaborated effort in calling people to pray for schools in the month of May. A prayer guide and a prayer calendar have been put together as resources to help you in this endeavor. And so we encourage you to go to our website to access those and then pray. Pray for your school or the schools in your community. Pray for the kids, pray for the teachers, and then encourage others to join in. And you can use the hashtag #UnitedWePrayForSchools to spread the word. I'm Graham Schnell for Focus on the Family Africa, inviting you to tune in next time when we'll once again help you and your family thrive in Christ.